my God, it's March 8th. It feels like it can't be 2020. Isn't it 2060? I feel like I've aged so much in the last couple of months. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. It's a gorgeous day in my neighborhood. That's all I can say. That's gorgeous. Everything else sucks, like incredible. But there is a good news. Can I give you a bit of good news? And
sure.
It's not going to be personal. It's going to be generic. And it was actually my tweet of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And my tweet of the day was by a guy named Zach Fruit. I don't think that's your name, Zach. But anyway,
My son's name is Zach.
Well, no, but Zach Fruit, I don't know. It's just, anyway, maybe you're like Zach Orange or Zach Pineapple. Anyway, so he tweeted out the following. A bouncer of this club asked a guy what consent was, and he literally couldn't answer, so they didn't let him in.
Yeah.
Oh, every feminist is just going, give me that bouncer. I want to date him. I'm like, it's like, isn't that it? That is the essence of Me Too. That's exactly what we wanted. We wanted a bouncer to ask. It's like, and you know, what's really interesting is I worked at a bar called The Pump. Can you believe it? I, who don't drink, worked at a bar called The Pump. It was right next to the Sears Roebuck in Northfield, Minnesota. And I don't know why I ever took a job there because I don't know anything about alcohol, and it's a bar. And so the first time I'm asked, I go to this table and the guy says, what kind of beer do you have? And I said, yellow and brown.
Mm.
And he went, excuse me?
Yeah.
Yellow and what? Yellow and brown? And the bartender's like this. Who the frick hired her? You know, it's like unbelievable. But I will tell you, at one point, there was a fight going on at the bar. And this big guy, what was his name? Something Puffer the Pusher. Puffer the Pusher, that was his name. Truly. Puffer the Pusher comes in with his girlfriend. And his girlfriend starts harassing the bouncer. And I mean, intentionally, so he would do something that then Puffer the Pusher would like beat up the bouncer.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very big at the time. I weighed 170 pounds. And I am watching this go on and I am outraged. So you know what I did? She was about to like punch the bouncer. And I walked over. I grabbed her arm. I wrapped my arms around her because I was very strong. And I said, you're so impolite. Mm. I think you need to leave this bar. And I literally carried her out. And I looked at Puffer. And I go, you're going to beat me up next? I said, I don't think so. I think you should follow your girlfriend. From that moment on, everyone in the bar went, and she's a religion major. I just want you to know, and she's a religion major.
Great.
That was me at 19, no, maybe 20. Anyway, isn't that cool?
Yeah, great.
Puffer the Pusher. Puffer the Pusher. Oh, I'll never forget it. Anyway, on that note, see, this is what happens when I read about a bouncer. I'm like, I relate to this. And I don't even drink. I don't even go to bars, except for maybe like 6 months when I worked at a bar. But that's it.
Are you doing Colonel Vindman?
Oh, my God. I'm doing – yes, Colonel Vindman, please. No, it's not going to be all right, Dad. It's not going to be all right, Dad. It's not going to be all right,
Next
Dad.
Month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful to my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant. Where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
All right, everyone. We are back, as you know, and thank you, Ken, for reminding me. We begin every day by discussing Vindman, not Arnie's stupid tweets, because it's really, really important that you have him in your head as you go into the voting booth in November of 2020. I was looking up to see what's the story with Colonel Vindman. I could only find a story from 2 weeks ago, so he's kind of gone quiet. But this I thought was important. I missed it. It was from The Hill. More than 1,000 veterans speak out against Trump's sustained attacks on Vindman. So if nothing else, they're beginning to rally. I actually said maybe we should put Vindman in charge of COVID-19. If nothing else, to organize, not because he's got knowledge necessarily, but because he's someone that you trust, because someone that you know who loves his country, and someone you know that will bring the best minds together to organize in order to make – like him and Fiona Hill. Can you imagine those two together?
Wow.
Oh, my God. I would feel so secure.
Yeah.
And then we can put Donald Trump down in Mar-a-Lago and lock the door. Okay, we just stay there, golf. Turn orange. Turn more orange than before, you know, but just don't open your mouth because every time you open your mouth, everything craters. It's kind of amazing. All right, sir, what's going on in your life?
Immigration is my thing. And it turns out, you know, I talked to you about the homestead children and they're being shipped out administration says that they're all with sponsors or back with family. Well, it turns out that the data on children who were separated at the border may be somewhat inaccurate.
This administration, an
shocking,
inaccuracy blow me away with
the
feather.
But the inspector general did a report, and the Trump administration's effort to track children that have been separated from their families has, quote, communication problems.
Jesus.
Communication, that's right. Like they have no clue what they're doing. But
they also have a math problem, but we won't go there.
That raised questions about the accuracy of the data, reported a watchdog on Thursday. The administration created this tracking system when it did its zero tolerance policy in 2018, and more than 2,500 kids were separated from their parents at the U.S.-Mexico border. But it turns out that the figure could be much higher. Who knows how much higher? Because they have communication problems.
Yeah.
And by the way, immigration officials have continued to separate some children from their parents at the border for reasons including a parent's suspected criminal history. Well, you know,
but
Trump administration
coming over the border, that is, exactly, exactly.
So that's why when I witnessed the Trump tent courts that tried people, the immigrants were always the defendants.
Right.
It's because when you come voluntarily across the border and say, please, please, I want to file an asylum claim,
right.
I'm fleeing violence in my country, you're a criminal because you crossed the border without the proper documentation. So they start off as defendants in a criminal prosecution rather than as claimants for asylum.
They're running away from crime to become a criminal.
Yeah. So now the people with suspected criminal histories are the ones that are still getting their children separated from them by the administration. And they're not tracking the chaos and confusion and trauma suffered by children who are separated.
Right.
So according to court figures, at least 955, almost 1,000 kids were separated between June 2018 and July 2019. That's just this past year until the summer. And it's long after the Trump administration claimed that it had stopped separating families. But the tracking system is flawed in part because details about whether separation from parents occurred are not automatically transmitted from Customs and Border Protection, the Border Patrol people who do the separating. And Health and Human Services, which has overall responsibility for dealing with the kids who've been separated. So the watchdog said that we don't even know how many kids are separated because the two agencies are not talking to each other. The people that separate them aren't talking to the people that are now housing them.
Get rid of Donald Trump as president in 2020. Do your country a favor. Do your children a favor. Do the world a favor. Do those people who are fleeing a favor. He is such a pox on everything. He is destructive. He is now he's you know, we remember the death panels during the that we talked about during the Affordable Care Act
the
and
Tea
all
Party
the Tea Party
about.
I mean, he is a death panel. That's everything you look at, whether it's at the border, whether it's coronavirus, whether it's whatever, anything he does now is toxic and deadly. And the word deadly is operative here.
Deadly and in the literal sense.
In the literal
not the
sense. Yes, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
So listen to this. The last thing I'll share with you. Health and Human Services officials maintain a spreadsheet of separated children. That's how they keep track. But the spreadsheet relies on manual entry, by human beings. And that is, quote, inherently vulnerable to error. Yeah, you think so? Raising questions about the accuracy of current data on separated children, wow, according to the watchdog's report.
I want to know who's putting in the data. It's not that it's a human being is doing it. It's what human being is doing it.
And
who's
whether, what their motivation is.
Exactly.
Maybe one for you, yeah, one for me. Yeah, maybe I won't report this one. Maybe I'll say they're
all
with
right
their parents.
So let's get calling. All right. So this is our Rethink the Week, everyone. We're still waiting for Dean Spiliotis to join us in studio. We'll also be joined by our good friend Glenn Smith from Texas, as well as Stephen Pimper from UNH in Manchester, as well as a CARSI fellow. So much on our plate right now. So I put a couple things for food for thought as we wait to begin our Rethink the Week. This one doesn't surprise me, and a lot of people are picking up on this. Andrew Yang tweeted out this morning, this would be a good time to put money directly into people's hands. Remember his $1,000 a month? Mm-hmm. Especially since people are going to find out that they may have to pay deductibles and co-pays, and they may not get time off from work, and their kids may be sent home because they may be closing down schools. Now what are they going to do? Because therefore they can't go to school because they have to take care of their kids. It's kind of shocking here, everyone. The other one that I also thought was absolutely unbelievable is this one. Paul Rudnick tweeted out, Jeanine Pirro imploded on Fox. Did you see this, Dean Spiliotis? I see Dean has just come into the studio. And that is that what she writes, what she said was screeching that while people dying from the coronavirus is quote unquote sad, the real challenge is CNN's treatment of Trump. She added, listen to this. This is an incredible quote. I would happily lick every golf club at Mar-a-Lago. Hold on, everyone. At Mar-a-Lago. Because that man is keeping this country germ-free and Febreze fresh. Okay. I'm fine with this. I'm totally fine with this. I can just see that we are now living in total la-la land. That they keep putting these people on Fox News. I wonder whether Fox understands the kind of human damage that now is happening by these people not only sort of propping up Donald Trump, but even saying what they're saying right now. All right, joining us, everyone, for our Rethink the Week is our following cast of characters. Stephen, are you there?
I am there.
Okay, Stephen Pimper is here. He is a poverty specialist. He's a fellow at the CARSI Institute. He teaches at UNH Manchester. Welcome to the program. I think the idea of homelessness and poverty is going to be on the way up, given what's happening to this economy. Joining us in studio is Dean Spiliotis. Dean Spiliotis is a civic scholar and a presidential scholar from Southern New Hampshire University. He also has a blog, nhpoliticalcapital.com, and you can hear him regularly on New Hampshire Public Radio on their Friday version of their Rethink the Week. So welcome, Dean. How are you?
Hi, Arnie. I'm doing well.
All right. We're going to be joined in seconds by Glenn. There we go. Glenn Smith is now joining us. Welcome to the program, Glenn.
Happy to be here with you. Arnie, how you doing?
I'm doing. What can I tell you? It's like there isn't even an answer anymore to how am I doing. I want to start out with something good as opposed to something bad vis-a-vis the coronavirus. And I just heard this morning that Bill Gates, obviously Bill Gates has a strong affinity to the state of Washington. Washington right now is the epicenter of what's happening with COVID-19. But Bill Gates had funded a study of viruses about 2 years ago. And it turns out he put $50 million into it. And it was just announced that Bill Gates, and I'll start with you, Stephen Pimper, Bill Gates may in fact be able to roll out within the next couple of weeks a home test for COVID-19. And I think right now, more than anything else, we can't stop it, but we can mitigate. And I think this is so exciting. And it's very, very interesting. I think Bill Gates thought that he would be saving Africa and he would be saving Asia and he'd be saving Latin America. And it turns out that he's turning his dollars and billions back home because the Trump administration has so sort of fallen flat on its face that it may turn out that home testing may be something that is needed desperately right now. Stephen?
Well, I mean, I hate to rain on good news, but I'm not sure that I see that necessarily as a positive sign. I mean, I think one of the things that is being revealed even more starkly than we've already known is the consequences of putting utterly incompetent people who are unconcerned with the effective functioning of public institutions in charge of those public institutions. And I am always troubled when we celebrate the actions of philanthropists stepping into what ought to be public responsibilities. If, in fact, this turns out to be real, and in the absence of the Gates Foundation's actions, we wouldn't have that testing, that's a terrific thing. But I think we should be cautious about celebrating the need of the whims of the private sector to step in for what ought to be public functions and public responsibilities.
Okay, so Dean, I'm going to just challenge a little bit of what you said, because Stephen, I totally agree with you. I am like down on philanthropy as the answer to what ails us, because in a lot of ways, this is really a government response where it isn't about the whim of the philanthropist du jour, whether it's the Koch brothers, whether it's Bloomberg spending $500 million to gloriously lose his nomination for president. But I'm going to say something here, Dean. Since what we know about this economy is that we have a form of capitalism called crony capitalism, and the crony capitalism has delivered a false economy. It's not an economy that has invested in our infrastructure. It's not an economy that has made people have the kind of affordable health care that they needed universally. It's not the kind of economy that really has brought up the middle class and made sure that people at the bottom could eat, let alone find affordable housing. It has trickled all the way up to the 1% and the 1/10 of 1%. So the fact that a Bill Gates has the capacity to do this, that a Bloomberg has the capacity to do this, that the head of Amazon.com has the capacity to do this. Well, you know what? Now all their billions are biting them in the proverbial you know what? Because all that money with no country and no manufacturing and no economy means that the money has no meaning. So the fact that we're seeing someone like a Bill Gates step up, I just tweeted out that Michael Bloomberg should spend the next $500 million and ship it off to the Gates Foundation so that he can assist, because right now we cannot rely on a dysfunctional government, and it's incredibly dysfunctional. And while Stephen is right, I don't know who steps in, given that we have a Republican Senate that refuses to take this president out of office. And if they are incapable of doing it, then who does step in here?
Just to clarify, so I understand your argument, when you say that all of their money is biting them in the ass,
yes,
are you suggesting it's their responsibility that the government build infrastructure and be prepared?
It's their responsibility that through their lobbyists and that they were able to buy deregulation, they were able to encourage.
So you're saying they're complicit in this breakdown.
Yes, totally.
That's all I wanted to clarify.
Oh, no.
I assumed
you
were saying
they were complicit. And what I'm suggesting is they got enormous tax cuts, we got a deficit. Right. Their companies got enormous tax cuts, even tax cuts they didn't want, with nothing. I mean, now they're paying, in some cases, negative taxes. So they have now divested in our infrastructure. They have assisted in divesting in our economy. They have now absorbed all the benefits of that economy. And now that economy is now going into the you-know-what.
No.
And I think that, you know, for them to step in now, I don't want them to be the permanent answer. No. Stephen is absolutely right. I think we need a government to function. But until we have a government that functions, what do you do, Dean Spiliotis?
No, I think I just wanted to clarify. And I thought that's what you were suggesting, that they were in some way complicit. I mean, I like Stephen's broader point that this shouldn't be the responsibility of private philanthropy, and it does speak to the failure of our institutions and the people running them right now.
Totally.
And kind of the, you know, it's funny. I remember back years and years and years ago having debates about kind of anti-intellectualism in the Republican Party, and this is a little bit – this sort of anti-expertise, you know, or, you know, Trump's concept is sort of expertise as a conspiracy, that this is, you know, that the civil service and the quote deep state, which are these institutional structures that we're talking about, that they're in some way out to get him or block him.
Right.
It is a concern. And, you know, when you any study of bureaucracy will tell you when you start prioritizing loyalty over expertise and qualifications, this is the kind of stuff that's going to happen.
Well, and so, Stephen, I'm not disagreeing with you. You hear me. And yet I'm looking at a window right now between now and the election and then January, when we will hopefully have a different president, that we are now in an expertise vacuum because Donald Trump gets in the way of expertise. It's not even that there aren't experts available that want to step up. The problem is who gets in their way but Donald Trump.
Well, he's aggressively pushing back, aren't he? He's saying it's a hoax. They don't know what they're talking about.
So
no, he knows more. We heard that he knows more than the scientists now. Yes,
and that the tests. Oh, wait, Glenn,
just
and the
like
test
he did with the generals.
Right, yes. Like the generals.
Same thing. He knows more than the scientists.
But it's better than this. The tests are perfect, Glenn. Tests are perfect.
I said like the call.
Like the call. I'm like, oh my God. So I want
you to honestly is not wrong.
No, he's right. The four tests.
In the same way, right?
In the same way, Art. So Glenn, I want you to weigh in here, and then I want to actually change to a topic that is maybe a little bit more endear to your heart and to the heart of Texas. But please weigh in.
Well, you know, I've been talking to a lot of most of the urban elected officials here, Democrats, and they've been trying to catch up and respond as they can. So the dilemma that they face, maybe I can speak to this is on the practical side of things, because there were no tests available, and by the way, because CDC assistance they could count on in the past was gone because of Trump's budget cuts,
Exactly. They
start off trying to address what is an actual pandemic behind the curve.
Yeah, right.
They got a ways to go. It's called a pandemic because it's likely going to outrun, at least in the short term, it's going to outrun your containment mitigation efforts. That's why it's going to be a pandemic.
Right.
So Trump's decisions over the last few years to cut CDC, not be prepared to produce these kind of tests, has put local health officials in a terrible bind.
Right.
The only good news I see is that they are stepping it up in some places, and I'm thinking about like Travis County, where we just canceled South by Southwest out of concern that it could spread here. But in many places like here, it hadn't really spread here yet. We can only hope that the federal government's efforts to catch up to it bear some fruit before we get in the same situation, say, Washington State's been in. I got my fingers crossed.
Yeah,
but there's no earthly reason to believe that will happen.
And
there's prayer.
There's prayer. Oh, no.
I'm a social scientist. We don't do that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what's so interesting to me is there's a fabulous piece. And the first piece that I posted for our conversation today was a piece at the Atlantic Monthly. It was entitled, "The U.S. Isn't Ready for What's About to Happen. Even with a robust government response to the novel coronavirus, many people will be in peril. And the United States is anything but prepared." But one of the things that she said, Stephen, which I actually posted on Facebook as well, was, I mean, we have tolerated a level of economic and social insecurity in this country that is not acceptable anywhere else in the world. We don't have the kind of wages that we need to have in this country. We don't have the kind of healthcare system like they have in other countries. We don't have the kind of, you know, time off for illness like they have in other countries. We don't have the vacation days like they have in other countries. We don't have, I mean, there are so many things that have made workers more vulnerable, that have made our healthcare system more vulnerable, that have depleted our public health systems. And it's not like Italy isn't having its problems and France won't have its problems and the Canadians won't have their problems. But in a lot of ways, we're going to be the problems on steroids because we have such a piece of Swiss cheese. It's not that we're not enormously wealthy. We have not invested the wealth in things that would actually maintain a level of stability and security that a country needs to, whether it's going to war, whether it's facing a 9/11, or in this case, facing a virus.
Yeah, I mean, I think that sort of the vulnerability goes along two tracks. One is American citizens themselves, right? If you look at comparative data on well-being across the world, that we at best fall at the very bottom of rich democracies, right? So you look at the 35 OECD countries. We are at the bottom of those rankings in
everything.
In everything, right? Yeah. In poverty, in elderly poverty, in child poverty, in child well-being, in life expectancy, in infant mortality, in access to health care, in rates of cancer, in rates of blood pressure, in rates of diabetes, right? Every one of those dimensions, we actually look much more like that next group of less developed countries, right? So we've already got a sicker and more vulnerable population to begin with,
right?
With, as you referenced, these dysfunctional, disproportionately disconnected and private sector run institutions of healthcare that, among other things, means it's harder to turn them to action, right? South Korea and now the UK are doing drive-through testing, right? Because they're able to sort of turn the centralized machinations of the NIH to particular purposes, understand that part of getting a handle on this is knowing where infections are, right? So trying to get to the point where South Korea is, which is 10 10,000 tests a day, right? We've done, what, 2,500 total to date.
That's right. Why they're doing drive-thrus at McDonald's.
It's kind of shocking. So Glenn, one of the things I was thinking about is that this is really, I mean, out of the ashes comes the phoenix. All right, this is what I'm hoping for. And obviously, we're going to see the ashes from this COVID-19. But as we were just talking about with Stephen, it does speak strongly to the need to reinstate belief in unions. That it turns out that what unions were fighting for is what working people need. You know, working people don't just need a good contract for wages, don't just need a good contract when it comes to, you know, their healthcare system. They need a good contract for the kind of benefits that are crucial now in a situation like this. All of a sudden, everything that people like me, the people that were accused of being left, you know, I said, you know, I was not doing the socialist conversation 20 years ago. I was not doing the left one, the progressive one, the liberal one. You know what I was doing, Glenn? I was doing the math. And the math suggested to me that their math sucked and my math worked. And my math worked for 95% of Americans and for the stability of America going forward. And their math only worked for them. And I think it's also an opportunity in real time to explain to people, this is a horrific way of learning a lesson, but it's a lesson that, guess what, can change us for the better going forward.
Glenn? You're right then and you're right now. And the scary thing is, let's take both of the crises that we face now with the collapse in oil prices
and the
coronavirus at the same time. In both of those realms, there's going to be more of that in the future, right? If there's any good news in the collapse of oil prices, it is the instability of the international oil and gas market is going to fast help us move more and more and more
to alternatives.
To renewables.
Yeah, exactly.
And to clean energy.
Exactly.
So that's the good part. The bad part of it is, like, just this downturn could cost Houston 20,000 jobs.
Yeah.
Soon. Like, that's 20,000 people that will soon lose their health care or their health insurance. And then what do we do if the virus spreads or in case of the next virus? The problem is, there's so many ways of talking about this. The difficulty is we've been walking along not facing the consequences of our political action or inaction.
Right.
And it's caught up with us. And now it's time we do that.
And let me just real quickly, Dean, and then we're going to end this segment. And that is that now more than ever, you begin to ask the question, why is healthcare related to a job? Why is healthcare related to a job? You just heard what he just said about Houston. 20,000. Mm-hmm. And not only were those 20,000 workers, those are some of the best paid people in all of Houston. They have some of the best, you know, health insurance, I'll put that in quote, of any of the people in Houston. That means they're holding up the healthcare system. So not only are their incomes going, not only are their job stability going, but those revenues that flow into the hospitals, the doctors, everything else, that money also disappears. And again, you have to start asking yourself the question, why the hell do we still connect a job with insurance? I don't want to talk about my great insurance I negotiated. I want to know if I have a job.
That's the debate we're having right now in the Democratic primary. That's Bernie's argument, although, you know, at the moment he's focused more on trade because of the Michigan contest tomorrow. That's the argument all along has been, do you just completely detach the two as you laid out the rationale for doing that, or do you have some kind of program in which some number of people can keep it if they want, or have some other public option that they can buy into? The way things look right now, we're probably not headed towards Medicare for All. But, we'll see what happens.
Well, that was yesterday.
We'll
I'm not
you never
sure.
know what's going to happen.
Anyway,
right.
All right. So, Glenn, Stephen, and Dean, we're going to be right back. This is Rethink the Week with The Attitude with Artie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. A little labor history is next. We need 4 hours.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1910. That was the day miners in Westmoreland County, Pennsylvania, struck for union recognition and the 8-hour workday. They hoped to beat back deep wage cuts and out-of-pocket costs for safety equipment and explosives. As many as 15,000 miners went on strike against 65 mines. Thousands were immediately evicted from company housing. The UMWA helped to set up tent cities. Area coal companies imported immigrant strikebreakers who had little understanding of English or why they were being hired. When they tried to quit and leave company housing, coal company police beat them back to work, refusing to let them leave until they paid the cost of relocation. The situation was so bad that the House Committee on Labor held hearings as to whether workers were being forced into peonage. Injunctions were enforced against strikers picketing on public property near the mines. Many were arrested for simply traveling along public roads. Strikers were also denied access to many municipal services whose facilities were on coal company property. Hundreds of strikers were arrested for trespassing and their leaders held on charges of conspiracy and intimidation. They were routinely harassed, beaten, and fired upon by sheriff's deputies, state troops, and the coal and iron police. Over the course of the strike, more than a dozen strikers and their family members were killed at the hands of security and police forces. The strike wore on through the brutal winter of 1910-1911. Hunger and disease spread throughout the tent cities. After 15 months, the UMWA called off the strike. The union was broke from disbursement of strike funds, and many blacklisted strikers had to leave the state to find work. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. When you buy almonds at the grocery store, it's likely they were grown in California.
California produces about 80% of the global almond supply.
That's Lauren Parker of the University of California, Davis. She says almonds have long thrived in the Golden State, but that's changing as the climate warms. During hot weather, almond trees need extra water, and California is facing more severe droughts, which make water supplies less reliable. So Parker is studying if the industry could shift north to parts of Oregon and Washington. She says frost damage is a big risk there now. But by mid-century, global warming could allow almonds to grow well in the Northwest.
Under climate change, what we anticipate seeing is a reduction in the frost risk, even for almonds, which bloom pretty early in the year.
She says it's not as simple as picking up and moving. The Northwest does not have the extensive irrigation systems and processing plants that California has.
So it's not to say that the Northwest won't be without its own set of challenges, but from a temperature perspective, at least the opportunity is there.
So the industry may be able to shift north and adapt. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Time has come. We've got to turn this world around. Call the mothers, call the daughters. We need the sister of mercy now. She'll be a hero, not a fool. She's got the power to change the rules. She's got something that men don't have. She is kind. And she understands. So let the ladies do what they were born to do. Raise the vibration and make a better place for me and you. So put a woman in charge.
Put a woman in charge.
Put the women in charge.
Put the women in charge.
I'm gonna cry. Of course, this is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Even more than me, Ken must be just completely morose after the loss of Elizabeth Warren from this campaign. And I do have to say something, Ken. So first of all, who sings Put a Woman in Charge?
Oh, this is Keb Mo. And it's not just for Elizabeth. Yeah, no, it's also because we're talking women. About who the vice president should be.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
It's all women.
Oh, my God. So joining us right now on the line is Glenn Smith from Texas, Stephen Pimper from Manchester, Dean Spiliotis in studio. It is our Rethink the Week. So I'm going to start with Dean and then I'm going to work back. So, Dean, Huffington Post called me about Biden and Bernie. And then right at the same time as Biden and Bernie were sort of the conversation, Elizabeth Warren decides to drop out. She decides not to endorse, yada, yada, yada. And at the end of so they were asking me, like, what did I think? And I said at the very end of this YouTube video on Huffington Post, I said, you know what? I think it's time for a little affirmative action for president. I just think that, you know, since it's all about you have to have the same qualifications, if not better, you know, that there has to be sort of diversity in the mix, yada, yada, yada. It's kind of like what we do with Afghanistan. Remember when we came into Afghanistan, we said 40% of the electorate has to be women, the people that, you know, get elected to the parliament. I'm like, I think we need this for president. And then lo and behold, it turns out we do have affirmative action. The Democratic Party is applying affirmative action to VP.
Yeah.
You know, it'll be a twofer. It'll be a woman. It'll probably be someone of color. So it's like we do believe in it. It's just not for president. And I am still, Dean Spiliotis, so disappointed that she waited and dropped out before the next debate. Because I think more than anything else, I wanted to see her in between the Bidens and the Bernies. Because I think this is her strength. And we needed to see that strength in comparison.
Yeah, and so, I think she probably would have won the debate, but I don't know that it would have fundamentally changed the underlying dynamics. I mean, this really is as much a reaction, I think, to Bernie Sanders' surging candidacy several weeks ago prior to this big dramatic shift back to Joe Biden. I mean, you know, I think people were looking for some sign of life from Biden, and I think that they were reassured by Jim Clyburn. And I'm not typically a huge proponent of endorsements. I think overall in the grand scheme of things, they're not the most important thing. But that was a kind of a pivotal moment in conjunction with showing that not only the incredible strength with African-American voters, but Bernie's weakness with African-American voters.
Right.
And you just – how can you be – sort of the nominee of the Democratic Party, if it's one of the biggest constituencies in the party, you know, if you can't connect with those voters. And, you know, there are big age differences by race. Younger voters of color tend to be more open to Bernie's message. But the core, hardcore kind of Democratic voters who vote consistently clearly registered some concern about Sanders' candidacy.
And Glenn, Jim Clyburn is a very, very powerful player in Washington. I mean, we have to remember, too, he's not a backbencher. He is part of the leadership team. So it's also and he has obviously years, decades. What is it? Isn't it the fish fry that he has in South Carolina? I mean, he is kind of – if there is a political god in South Carolina, it is Jim Clyburn. And the fact that Jim had been reluctant and had not said anything and then delivered that sort of really, I think – unbelievable endorsement. I mean, I don't know how it didn't move anyone.
Right at the moment when African Americans were weighing in significantly for the first
time
in the process.
We exactly.
not heard from the community in any significant way because of the nature of the first couple of contests.
And I'm sure they were actually thinking about whether we really want to do this. And
well, and they were, and they needed and they needed guidance, and they got their guidance. Exactly.
Yeah.
So Glenn, you are a political operative. The one thing that really sort of strikes me as kind of frustrating, and Paul Waldman from the Washington Post actually tweeted this out, and that is that Bernie is talking about the DNC cabal because all of a sudden it was Amy and then it was Pete and then it was, you know, Kamala and now this morning Cory Booker. And it's like all of a sudden within like 48 hours of Jim Clyburn doing his thing, we saw them all sort of walking away like simultaneously in order to endorse Joe Biden, who I still think is the weakest candidate of all of them that's running, but maybe weak is what we need right now. I'm saying that not because I don't like him. I just don't think he has shown – there is no difference between the Biden I saw in Iowa, not who voted for him, but the Biden that presented himself. The Biden I saw in New Hampshire, not who voted for him, but Biden himself. The Biden we saw in Nevada, not the voters, but Biden himself. And the only thing that changed between Nevada and South Carolina – was Jim Clyburn. That was all that changed. And I'm not sure that that is a strong candidate. What he now has is strong support. But is it a cabal, as Bernie is suggesting? Because that makes Bernie, I think, look smaller and not bigger than he should be at this moment.
Well, it's kind of funny. So like most of the time, speaking of the National Democratic Party, people say they couldn't organize a pancake breakfast until something happens they don't like, and then all of a sudden they're sinister abilities to rule the universe were talked about.
Right.
So, no, there was no cabal behind the scenes that made that stuff happen. And I disagree slightly about the Clyburn endorsement and its effect on the Super Tuesday primaries, because I think that these voters were already moving that way in big numbers. And because I think especially to talk just about the African-American voters here in Texas, they sort of knew in their bones what four more years of Trump could mean to their lives.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And they are looking for an escape, and they didn't trust Sanders.
Right.
which had never built much trust with him since he ran in 2016. So I have to give them some credit for making a judgment that sincerely, I don't think it was knee-jerk. I give them credit for making the decision that they made. And I put this another way when I try to explain, because some of the things that Sanders and others and Warren, I have one other point about Warren to make.
Yeah, we're
going to
please, yes.
But it's sort of like, okay, think of America is a car that's been in a wreck and it's on fire and we're still in it. And in that circumstance, what people want most is to be pulled from the car and have the fire put out, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. You can't walk up to the window of the burning car and say, I've got a Medicare for all plan for you. They're not in the mood to buy it at the moment, as important as it is to our future. It's a really kind of a time-dependent marketing problem.
Right.
Now, I want to say one thing before we leave that about
Elizabeth,
the women candidates for president this time and the sadness I felt about Elizabeth Warren leaving. Some good news. This is kind of remarkable, although we in the Democratic primary in Texas, where there was a female and a male running against one another, women won all of them. 30
wow.
of them.
Wow.
Not Jessica Cisneros.
Excuse me?
Didn't Cuellar beat Cisneros?
These are judicial races.
Oh, judicial races.
Okay. Keep going.
Yeah. Yes, that's right. I mean, and that's Laredo, and that was, you talked about, it's like a good old boy and girl Webb County thing down there. It's going to be hard to beat Cuellar. But no, I'm just speaking of in the judicial races, voters, Democratic voters' preferences were for the female candidates, which is a good sign for the future.
Okay. So, Stephen, so let me say a couple of things. I think that as I'm thinking about this Biden Bernie thing, and I do think that there's a level of exhaustion, and because there is this level of exhaustion from Donald Trump, it isn't just a question of electability. Is that are they emotionally prepared for a revolution? And I think right now they are just looking for a blanket. They want to like pull the blanket over their heads and say, has this all this evil, toxic, lying stuff gone away? Okay, now what do we need to fix? And I understand, I mean, I am the urgency person. I am the hope person. I believe that we need to make change. But I also think that the way that Bernie packages it sometimes is that there's a lot of anger in how he packages things. And I think that I believe in change too. I'm dramatic about change. I'm the change agent. I'm just not, I don't want to package it angry. Because anger is exhausting, and anger means people sort of feel that they're on the defensive. I want them to be open and receptive to change. I don't want them to be sort of in the defensive mode. And sometimes I feel like, Bernie, that you get in the defensive mode. Maybe I'm being naive here. Maybe I'm just being an old woman. But that's kind of what I see.
I mean, as Glenn said about COVID-19, there are about 1,400 different directions we could go with this. I mean, I think that I also do not think that it is necessarily a Democratic leadership cabal. I do think that to some extent it's worth thinking about the extent to which the if in fact we wind up with the nomination of someone like Biden, that is a media failure, in that it is, as others have observed, created a world in which everyone likes to think of themselves as a pundit, because the quality of national political coverage is so desperately poor and so disproportionately focused on the horse race. Who's up? Who's down? Who's winning? Who's losing? Who said this thing to that other person, right? As opposed to more complicated, serious political science, maybe even, call me crazy, informed analysis of both what we know about elections and about what we know of governance. We've got any number of polls that show people voting not on behalf of the candidate who they thought would be the most effective president, but the candidate who they thought most other people would be thinking of as the best president. So we've got this elaborate sort of effort to gauge the behavior of other people. I don't know that we've got good tools yet to measure the effects of that, but that seems to me a good chunk of what's going on here.
Ken, you wanted to weigh in?
Yeah, I just wanted to respond to two points early, but first Glenn's Bernie Carr analogy, which I think is really a good one, that the first thing you want to do is put out the fire and get people out. But the question is, who is best able to put out the fire and get people out? if I'm in a burning car, do I want someone who has two broken arms and two broken legs and say, oh, yeah, that's the person I want to pull me out?
Who doesn't know how water works.
Yeah, who doesn't know how water works. Any of those things. I mean, the question is not whether the first thing we have to do is defeat Trump. The question is whether Biden is the person who's best able to do it, or is he, in fact, more likely to stumble and not do it? And the second thing let me just say the other thing, which is now it's really easy to talk about, and I agree with the conversation about Sanders is just too toxic to be the one, and Biden.
Listen 6 months a year ago to me. I didn't want him to run.
But Biden is the only thing we got now. But how does any of this analysis explain why 2 months ago
he was dead on arrival?
The other 12 candidates weren't considered viable alternatives, especially Elizabeth Warren. But any of the others.
So let me ask Glenn a question, because you are the political you've done campaigns.
Out of the car, I mean.
Right, you've run campaigns. So let me just say something that I think is, once again, the media thought that they were helping us out, but I think they were actually doing a detriment. And that is that the way the media covered Sanders was not useful. Sanders has a lot of weaknesses. Sanders' anger is a lot of weaknesses. Sanders doesn't have the numbers, which is a lot of weaknesses. But instead, what they did was they either didn't cover him or they marginalized him. I have never seen a man trashed more than on MSNBC. Never, never, never. And not only was he trashed all the time, but he didn't appear on MSNBC. So you had like the twofer. And I think one of the reasons why the Bernie bros got angrier and angrier was that they were sort of fed this anger by the stupidity of the media, not to create a level playing field. And frankly, Glenn, I actually think Bernie would have imploded on his own petard, because if you had given him time and he couldn't answer the questions, or his anger became even more self-evident, or his brusqueness became part of the conversation, you would have been able to step back and say, I believe in these policies, but I'm not sure he's the one who could deliver them. And I think they, in a way, let Bernie sort of operate in the place that he loves to operate with, 25,000 people in a stadium. But I think in the end, that's not how you become president. And that's not how you act as president. You act as president with a cabinet around you. You act as president in a much smaller setting, Glenn. And I think by not giving him that smaller setting, they just created anger and they didn't actually inform us, Glenn.
Well, I think, go back to the media analysis that was talked about earlier is spot on, too. I mean, and it plays into what I talked about our disconnection from the consequences of our political actions. So they cover the horse races and they cover the relative standing of candidates, but they're not good at telling us that what we're really talking about is the health of our neighbor. Right?
The health very good.
They don't tell us that, well, if you go this way, this is going to, they don't cover that. They walk away from it and they're on. I mean, and among elected officials themselves, I mean, this is one of the saddest things. I guess it may have always been true, but it's so pronounced now. There's only one measure among themselves that they consider when they think about their self-esteem or their self-worth, and that's are they reelected. What they actually accomplish in office is secondary. Yeah. Like their entire status among themselves, it's like the official seniority plans. You know what I mean? So that the consequences of the people that we're asked to vote for or vote against, the consequences of our votes aren't given enough attention from the media. So if you have an Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders who are speaking all about the consequences, right?
Right.
They're running against the wind of the media from the beginning.
Exactly.
Because the media doesn't want to cover the consequences. They just want to cover the personality race.
Right. So, Dean, as I'm looking, and I'm going to just challenge a little bit of what Ken said about the weak, about, the broken arms and the broken legs, and that's the guy that's pulling you out of the car. And that is, I'm going to give Biden some positive props. And what I'm going to say is he actually is an institutionalist. He's been about Washington a long time. And the best way we're going to be able to judge Joe Biden is by the people that he puts in his cabinet and by the person he picks as VP. Because I think if he's honest, his wife has probably had a conversation with him and said, you're getting old, honey. She knows it, too. That's why she protected him, because he couldn't protect himself. And I think, but she also knows that he loves this country and that the son that he so misses, Beau, who died, that if he is to live up to this image that Beau had of his father, it's that he has to realize his weaknesses and instead of sort of covering for them, make sure that the strength that's in a potential cabinet, in the policy people around him, fill in for those weaknesses. And I think there is a love of country and love of future with Joe that, as concerned as I am about him not being the strongest candidate, I am not quite sure that he won't have a really strong administration. And I think that there's potential.
Right.
Right. Now, so that is the biggest fear, is that I think the weakest candidate is going up against Donald Trump, but now the weakest candidate has something nobody ever thought we would have, which is COVID-19.
When you say, just to clarify, when you say weakest candidate, you mean among the Democratic field or in terms of ability to beat Trump?
I think among the Democratic field, he is the weakest. Okay. And right now, against Donald Trump before COVID-19, I think he was weak, given the nature of the economy. After COVID-19, I don't think he is so weak, because it's pointing out all the fact of living with his lies and what that means for Wall Street, what that means for the economy, and what that means for the health and safety of the American
people. Biden has a little bit of that sort of older, happy warrior kind of feel to him, sort of a little Reagan-esque kind of, not comparing with Reagan, but I remember kind of had, back in the 80s, people who supported Reagan would be like, okay, well, maybe he's not quite like with the program, but, you know, he has good, you know, in their mind, he had good people around them. And so that may be the case. There's already tremendous speculation about, you know, who's going to be his VP and where he'd be elected, who would he have
Attorney
in his
General,
cabinet,
all that kind of stuff.
And, you know, I think we have a pretty good sense of what the universe of candidates would look like were he to win. And it would be kind of a, I don't want to say a restoration, but it would be this sort of, you know, return to kind of, quote, normalcy, at least among kind of democratic institutional
And actually beyond normalcy, because let me say something else, Stephen. I'm going to give credit to Bernie now. God, I can't believe I'm saying all these nice things. And what I'm going to say about Bernie is that Bernie changed the agenda of the Democratic Party. I mean, where we couldn't even say the word Medicare for All because it was like, you know, wash your mouth out with soap. We would arrest the doctors who wanted Medicare for All when President Obama was president and they were talking about the Affordable Care Act. His answer to Medicare for All was to make sure that the chairman of the committee arrested them and shipped them out. So we have gone light years from there. You know, public option now is the minimum, not the maximum. So when you look at the progressive agenda, a lot of what either comes out of Joe's mouth or what eventually will come out of his cabinet will be much more progressive than if Bernie had not run. So I do think that the Joe we have today is a very different Joe that we would have had if only Hillary had lost in isolation. And it wasn't because of Bernie and sort of the discussion of some of these ideas that I think they've now sort of infiltrated the Democratic Party and are now part of the basic agenda of Democrats. Am I crazy here?
That's a separate question, obviously.
Okay.
I think that analysis is correct. I mean, I think it's just as Hillary Clinton of 2016 was different in terms of her stated policy positions than Hillary of 2012 and Hillary of 1996. That's not necessarily a reflection of the fact that she changed, but that the party changed around her, and that any president is constrained by the policy terrain of the party itself. And that's going to be true. Any Democrat going into the White House, is going to have that party around them that has been pushed to the left, not just in this cycle, but over a period of years. I guess, you know, as I think about, I mean, as I've said on this program before, I am less concerned about trying to game out who's more electable, because I think, as we're seeing with the situation right now, it's larger economic forces that have much more impact than any individual candidate when all is said and done. When I think about Biden, what I worry about is precisely who those people are he surrounds himself, Think about Treasury. He's going to go back to the same folks who were running Treasury in the Obama years, which was the same damn people who crashed the economy the last time around. He's going to wind up putting the same
I'm naive. Oh, Glenn, I'm so naive. I think you're absolutely wrong. I don't think it'll be Goldman Sachs. I'm just telling you right now, because there are a base of 35%, the Bernie base, that really is strong, outspoken, activist, and whatever, and you will be throwing every one of them under the bus if you go there.
$10 right now.
All right, $10.
I'm with Stephen. I said this last week on the show.
I'll take you on the $10. I'm going to be in La La Land, Glenn. But I actually think that this is now. Now, Glenn, do you think I'm wrong here? I don't think he'll go back to Goldman Sachs.
I want him on the bet on your side.
Okay, good. 10-10. That's 20 to 20.
Okay, so we got 2-2.
Here we go.
All right, remember this date, everyone. March 9th. Go on, Ben.
It's even more than that. I think that if Biden manages to win the election and get in the White House, he's got to distribute power across
Yes, he's
Congress
got to heal.
And his cabinet in ways that hasn't been done in a very long time.
Absolutely.
And if he doesn't do that, it's going to inhibit his ability to get anything done, and it will kind of further the splits in the party. Think of it as like the opposite of Trump.
Exactly.
Because with Trump, everything was about him, and
exactly.
Nobody had any power to do anything else. In this case, Biden's got to be sort of like a figurehead and hand the power to his appointees and to Congress to get the stuff done. And I think he's going to circumstances almost force him to do that.
And I might be naive, but I'm going to just end this way. And again, I'm going to end with Glenn and Dean. I want you to weigh in as well.
Sure.
I remember when we had a guy running against, what's his name, John Rao, Judd Gregg for U.S. Senate. And John Rao came within like 2 or 3 percentage points of beating Judd Gregg, a very powerful family, a powerful Republican, had been the governor. So John Rao thought that he should run again because, after all, look what he did against Judd Gregg. Do you know what's interesting? And I think Bernie should have done this, but I don't think he did. What Bernie didn't do after the 2016 election was ask the question, was it about me, Bernie, or was it about not Hillary? And what we learned with John Rao was that it was about not Judd. It wasn't that people completely loved John Rao and his agenda and his politics and the fact that he was a different Democratic voice. It was they couldn't stomach Governor Gregg. And that was what happened. And then, of course, John Rao could never even beat his way out of a paper bag in the next primary. And I think one of the things that Bernie never did was make an assumption that somehow those people, like in Michigan, were going to be with him, instead of realizing that what Michigan was doing, as much as they may have been embracing him, they clearly were rejecting Hillary. And to some extent, maybe she deserved it. But to not know that going into this next campaign, I think was a detriment to him, Glenn.
Well, that's really, really, really quick. You're right. And that's a really hard thing for humans to do. They come close to winning the basketball game, and it was all about the shot percentage that they had, right? And so they're very proud of that. Hard to step back and go and look at where they screwed up, as opposed to what they got right, or what they needed to do better.
Right.
On the other hand, though, there really is a large part of the party, and maybe the country, that agrees with Bernie and Elizabeth on policy, that we really need a change from the Goldman Sachs mentality.
But Bernie made it impossible for Elizabeth to actually emerge.
I'm just saying it's not just that Bernie can't see, it's his personality.
And Dean, smart people around Bernie, why didn't they do those exit interviews?
Same cast of characters.
I know.
It's the same people. Bernie, what you see, what you get. He's very consistent. That some people see that as a virtue, other people say it's problematic.
And what is a virtue is this amazing Rethink the Week. Stephen Pimper, Glenn Smith, Dean Spiliotis, thank you so much for joining us. I truly appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Arnie.
All right, and we end with?
Well, we're going back to coronavirus. We end with the vaccine song.
Wow, we have one, huh? Oh.
Back in the day, they didn't care about the children. They just had more and more. If you lost a few big, what's new? It's what nature had in store. They didn't care if Sally died of flu, Jimmy meningitis when he turned two. Nobody kicked up a great big fuss if he lost one to pertussis. Well, actually, I don't believe that's true. They felt grief and pain like you. Talking just a few generations ago, they loved the kids, didn't want to let them go. As a father with a brand new baby, want to do what's right, nothing crazy. Try to get him sleeping on his back in the crib. Get a car seat and strap him in. Now some people on Oprah and the internet can pass opinions and cause me to fret. They say vaccines are dangerous, sounds outrageous, but I want it just the same. Should I listen to my doctor or heed the invective of a Playboy bunny and a pet detective? Toxins are bad, except in the case when you like to stick a deadly one in your face. 55, this fella Jonas Salk cured polio and how the mothers talked. Hallelujah, no more iron lungs.